I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The reasons for the water shortage and the many consequences of that shortage that's located west of the Rockies is our subject matter this hour. We know that California has a consequential short-term drought. The Colorado River Basin provides water for seven states, and it is drying up, and that problem is entering its 16th year. There are many things to talk about this hour. Federal subsidies that are encouraging farmers to plant crops that use the most water. How water allocation was determined on a system that may be way out of date. Individuals' use of water. Is climate change to blame for the water shortage? How changing what we eat could save as much water as flows through the Colorado River in 1 year? And what happens to the whole country if the water crisis gets worse? We have two guests with us this hour. Abram Lustgarten is with us the first part of the show. He writes about energy, water, climate change, and anything else that has to do with the environment for ProPublica. His investigation into fracking for natural gas was recognized with the George Polk Award for Environmental Reporting and many other awards as well. Later in the program, we'll be speaking with Douglas Kenny, who is director of the Western Water Policy Program located at the University of Colorado Law School. We're welcoming phone calls all hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter at KDunnShow. Abram, thanks very much for being with us. Hello.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. All of the media attention has been centered really on California, but you remind us in your recent article that every state, almost every state west of the Rockies, has been facing some kind of water shortage. For how long and how severe?
Yeah, that's right. The drought in the Colorado River Basin began about 16 years ago, and it's not quite as extreme or severe in any given year as what you're seeing in California over the last year or two. But over time, it's an annual shortfall of precipitation that has allowed the nation's two biggest reservoirs to get lower and lower each year. So they're now both below 50% full. One is about a third full now. And it's just continually stressing the seven states and 40 million people that rely on it, in part because those states have continued to withdraw the exact same amount of water that they normally use every year, not adjusting for that drought.
How can you keep withdrawing that amount if the water isn't there?
Well, the reservoirs have actually made that possible. But what you are asking about is a core problem on the Colorado River Basin, which is that by law, from going back to an agreement between those states in 1922, they've essentially divided between them an amount of water larger than what actually flows through the river on average every year. So regardless of drought, that region is set up to essentially operate with a deficit. It filled its reservoirs decades ago, and it's basically been withdrawing from that savings account, like raiding its retirement account, every year since.
And that becomes hugely problematic in what year, do we know?
Well, the current drought started around 2001. It's been getting lower and lower with a couple of years of small rises since then. The U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, which is the agency that manages those reservoirs, was at first predicting a shortage declaration, which is their emergency shortage, for next year. That might be put off a year or so. Now Colorado and the Rockies got a good amount of precipitation, but it's really sort of what looks to be delaying the inevitable.
Mm-hmm. What we all know that California has taken big measures to get people to not use as much water, and I guess that farmers aren't getting as much water now. Is this something, are these kinds of plans being put in place in other states west of the Rockies?
I mean, every state that we're talking about is very cognizant of the value of water and the water shortages that they face. So the big kind of deficits that we're seeing are they're systemic in a way that that individual conservation can't easily fix. That's to say that the law allows a certain amount of water to go to farms and then insists that the farmers actually use all of that water every year.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, cities like Denver and Las Vegas have done a lot and actually made quite great progress in cutting down individual per capita water use and conserving water, much like California has done. Las Vegas had to do that many, many years ago. But it's not enough to correct the large systemic problems with water management across the region.
Mm-hmm. You remind us of federal subsidies that farmers have been given to plant crops like cotton that use a whole lot of water. But you also remind us that there are a lot of other things that are grown and animals that need food that is grown with a whole lot of water.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, across the region, farms for food production, for agriculture, use, you know, between 70 and 80% of all of the water in the region.
Oh, my.
And the majority of that water goes to grow feed grasses, namely alfalfa and other forage grasses. And people don't consume that directly. That's grown to feed animals, and namely beef, and or to be exported to other countries, which also use it to feed their cattle. So essentially the single largest user of water in the western United States goes for the production of protein, of all sorts of meats. And that's, you know, a sort of a key connection with water and the drought that I don't think a lot of people quite realize.
Yeah, and would I wonder if anybody's making a campaign to say, hey, if you eat one less meat meal a week or one day without meat, what does it do? It gives you another year's worth of water in the Colorado River? That's amazing.
Yeah, well, so we ran some calculations along with a water study organization in Europe that helped us out, and what we essentially looked at is if you add up the amount of beef that Americans eat on a daily basis and the water footprint of each 8-ounce serving of that beef, which is, I think, about 2,500 gallons of water equivalent for each 8-ounce serving of beef. If each American stopped eating meat just one day a week, like a meatless Mondays kind of thing, the water equivalent saved would be equal to the amount that flows through the Colorado River in a year.
Really?
And that's not to say that would be a direct savings if such a campaign were undertaken, but it gives you an idea of,
yes,
of the scale of the problem.
Yeah. What we really have been hearing a whole lot about is almonds, and I know it's made me think twice about buying almonds, but are they a major source here of the problem, using a lot of water, or do other things use it as much?
You know, almonds use a lot of water. That's absolutely true. And in California, in the Central Valley, California, where the short-term crisis is particularly acute, you know, almonds have become a very high-profile use of that water. But when you look systemically over the entire region and all of the food that's grown and all of the alfalfa that I was describing and a lot of other water-intensive crops, almonds are a relatively small use of water in the western United States.
Mm-hmm. So what does climate change have to do with all of this?
Well, climate change is certainly exacerbating the problem. Studies of the effects of climate change on the Colorado River predict a gradual decline in the amount of precipitation that region will enjoy. Doesn't mean the current drought will continue exactly as it has, but over time there's not going to be as much precipitation as, say, there was a century ago. In California, they've found much the same. Climate change has, if nothing else, raised temperatures, which has, led to higher water use, quicker evaporation off of reservoirs and canals and that sorts of thing. So climate change is essentially diminishing the net amount of water that's available to work with. But it's really a policy and management problem that divides up the existing water and as a lot of my reporting has found, kind of mismanages that water. So we put ourselves in a very precarious position of dividing up more water or using all of the water that's available, and then climate change comes along and just sort of cranks up the pressure and makes things just a little bit worse.
Mm-hmm. There's a picture in the ProPublica report, recent one, of migrant workers, volunteers at a food distribution event in Fireball, California. The caption says, serving hundreds of farm workers who are out of work because of the drought. Can you give us more information on that?
Well, it's really a California problem more than the broader region. California Central Valley there are many farms that have had to curtail their operations, fallow fields for the season. When they do fallow their fields, there's nothing to harvest. And so the labor pool that's dependent on coming in and finding that work for the season, obviously is impacted, as are those communities that, that depend on all of the revenues that come from farming. So there are quite localized, serious economic impacts from not being able to farm as well.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of federal money coming in to help with this drought.
Yeah, I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but President Obama has passed a quite significant drought relief package in California. And there are sort of tangential federal benefits available through the U.S. Department of Agriculture that are not brand new, but also are meant to help farms and farmers, for example, install and use more efficient irrigation equipment, make those investments in the type of technology that would help them grow the same crops with less water. Those are all federal efforts to essentially curtail water use.
Yeah. We welcome phone calls. We have a few more minutes now with Abram, and then we switch guests. But if you have questions for him, please feel free to give us a call right now. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well. We're talking about the water shortage west of the Rockies and what it means for the rest of the country, and why it's happening and what the effects are on flora and fauna. And let's talk about the effects on the rest of the country. It would seem to me as though if this goes on for it, we're already feeling some of the effects here in terms of prices of grocery, but there could be a lot of ramifications nationwide, couldn't there?
Yeah, well, there's several ways that, what happens in the West in response to water affects the rest of the country. And certainly an enormous amount of the nation's food production comes from California and southern Arizona, and to a slightly lesser degree, Colorado and Wyoming as well, in terms of the forage grasses that are grown there. So those foods could theoretically become more scarce and more expensive. And in California, where crops have been directly impacted already, you're starting to see that. One thing that's not discussed quite as frequently is the impact on power supplies and the cost of power. Regionally, the big dams in the western United States, and especially the ones on the Colorado River, all produce hydroelectric power, and that power is contracted out through the federal government to local power grids and power distributors. And they've been having difficulty over the last couple of years producing the amount of power that they're contracted to supply. And so when that happens, for example, the Hoover Dam at Lake Mead outside of Las Vegas, essentially, the government can't deliver its power on the contract, and the power grid has to go and buy that elsewhere and passes on those additional costs to consumers. And the third way is that as the economies of these states, California, et cetera, are impacted, the economic well-being of California affects right. The entire country. So you just have an added economic pressure.
Hmm. I know you've done award-winning work on fracking, and our first caller has a question that's related to fracking, so I'm sure you can answer this or comment on it. Sarah in Green Bay, hi.
Hi. I just read recently that the state of Colorado sells extra water, and that normally in the past that sale of that water, or the water rights, I guess it is, has gone to farmers, which of course is used and then gets back in the system. But that more recently, the extra water has been going to fracking companies, and once that water is used, it's not reusable. It's lost to people forever, and I'm just wondering if I'm right about that or if you have any comments on that.
Yeah, you are right about that. There have been a couple of deals that I've tracked that have worked along those lines. There are water markets across the West, and Colorado's especially is quite mature, and as you described, that allows different interests to try to buy those water rights or trade them, depending on what use they hope to make of it. The oil and gas industry has been quite active in Colorado in seeking more water supplies, and it's also true that when they do use it, whether for fracking or other parts of their production, generally it's disposed of deep underground in injection wells and does not go back into the natural hydrological system the same way that field runoff does.
So who's making a decision as to whether or not that should be factored in to a decision as to whether or not fracking should be taking place in some of these states?
Well, really, that the kind of decision you're describing, is a level above one about fracking in particular, and really just about water use. And one of the things that I focused on in my reporting is the old set of laws that govern the way water is used in the West, and water rights are distributed and defined. And essentially, they're about a century old, and they were distributed to people on a first come first served basis, and they're widely viewed as property rights. So the value of a piece of land might be tied to the value of the water that comes with it. And in more recent times, those water rights have been able to be traded. But there are all sorts of rules around that water having to be used. It's required to be used every single year. And really, a bunch of traditions that have kept this century-old policy and way of distributing water in place. It's never been modernized to consider what water managers would call the quote-unquote beneficial use of that water, whether that's a judgment that fracking is not an appropriate use or alfalfa is not an appropriate use or casinos are not an appropriate use. There's just no mechanism in water law to make those sorts of value judgments right now.
Ooh. Well, don't you think the time is ripe for an examination of water law?
Well, there's a lot of people talking about that right now, and for obvious good reason. I think
right.
The next guest will have some good thoughts on that.
Yeah. And when you talk about having to use a certain amount of water, you write in your piece about flooding that's done in California so that you can use all the water that's allocated even if you don't need it. So you get the same amount of water next year? Is that the story?
Yeah, that's right. It's everywhere. It's not just California, Colorado, Arizona. The water rights that I just described, let's say you get the right to use a unit of 10 amount of water, and the law basically says that you get to keep that right to use those 10 units of water so long as you actually need it, and you actually do use it every year. And the state kind of watches over and keeps an eye on what you use that water for. And if you only use 8, the risk is, and the law allows them to come back and say, well, it looks like you only need 8. So if you conserve your water in any given year, then you face the risk of losing the rights to the whole amount that your family may have had for the last century, or that has been passed down with your land for the last century. And so to avoid that risk facing that water curtailment, farmers and others essentially make sure that they use the maximum amount of water that is available to them every single year so that their total water rights are never in question.
Whew, that just makes you go, really? Really?
It doesn't make a lot of sense.
It doesn't make any sense. In terms of the drought, is there any way of knowing how long this is going to last, and what would alleviate it if you had, 1 year of terrific rain, or if that's not enough?
I haven't talked to any scientists who can predict the end of a drought. In California, I've talked to scientists of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration who have said that it would likely take about 2 or 3 years of above average precipitation followed by 2 or 3 years of normal precipitation to get California back on track. And that's in terms of its rivers and its reservoirs, and not counting the quite extreme depletion of underground aquifers that's happened there. So that gives you an idea for one place where I have done reporting on that. As I mentioned, Colorado had a great water year this year. On a year-to-year basis, they don't really have a shortage. It would take several of those to replenish the big reservoirs. I calculated that Lake Powell, which is about 50% full, would take about 12 years to fill back up to its
goodness full gracious. It's a long time. Abram, thank you very much. We're going to continue and talk more about water law and how it may need to be updated as we carry on. Thank you, Abram, for your writing and for being with
us. Thank you for your interest.
Yeah,
thank
our pleasure. Abram Lustgarten, senior reporter for ProPublica. We're going to continue with Douglas Kenny in just one moment, and your phone calls, too. So if you're online, we will not ignore you. We'll be with you just very soon, so stay with us. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our subject this hour is the reasons for the water shortage west of the Rockies and the consequences of that shortage. We're going to concentrate on the part of the conversation that we mentioned in the last 25 minutes, and that's why there isn't some kind of policy that all the states have gotten together or the federal government to determine what the allocation of water should be and whether or not some of these laws are too antiquated. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joining us now is Douglas Kenny. He's director of the Western Water Policy Program located in the University of Colorado Law School. He researches and he writes on many issues, including law and policy reform, river basin and watershed level planning, and strategies for solving complex resource issues. And we'll be welcoming phone calls for Douglas in just one moment. Hi, Douglas. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, we got into this a little bit during the last 25 minutes, but tell me more about this first-come, first-serve policy that in many ways seems to regulate the allocation of water in 2015, even though it was designed over 100 years ago.
Sure. It's a system that made a lot of sense at the time. The origins of this system, known as prior appropriation, go back to about the 1850s, and this was a time when there wasn't a lot of people in the West. The national priority was to encourage people to get out in the West and to start farms and to there's a lot of mining at the time and that sort of thing. And the thought was people weren't going to make the investments to build water projects and to divert water onto their fields or to their mines if they had to deal with the threat of someone coming into the region 5 or 10 years later and, you know, moving in right upstream and taking the water that the first user was already using. And so the idea was, if you got there first and you used water first, then you established a legal right to use that water forever. And it made a lot of sense at the time, and it encouraged Western settlement. And it was very, very successful in terms of encouraging Western settlement. The problem is, once you fast forward 100 years or 150 years, you have a lot of water that is allocated to uses that may not reflect modern priorities.
So tell me how the states factored in. Was that true of states, too, then, that the first who were, did they have a formal application process? The first state that was founded got access to more water than a subsequent state?
Well, this was certainly a concern among the Western states. So within the states were comfortable with this idea of first come, first served. But between the states, the issue came up, and the Colorado River is the best example. This issue came up that the states at the end of the river, namely California and Arizona, were growing and settling much faster than the states upstream, such as Colorado and Wyoming. And so the thought was there needed to be some sort of special process to deal with these relations between the states. And what normally happened was on these rivers is that states would organize and would negotiate an agreement known as an interstate compact. And these compacts specify how water is supposed to be shared between the states.
Hmm. And we were talking a little bit toward the end of the last interview about some of the allocation. I mean, it's goofiness that you're allotted a certain amount of money of water, and if you don't use all of it, then you may use it for a ridiculous purpose, and it becomes even more ridiculous when you're in a drought, for heaven's sake. So you're flooding a field, so you make sure you get the same amount of water the next year. It's crazy.
Well, again, this is one of those rules that made a lot of sense in its origins, and that is, I mean, Abram gave you the example of a farmer who was allocated 10 units of water, and if they find a way to be more efficient and only use 8 units, then those 2 units are taken away from them. Well, the origin of that law was a good one, in that the principle was you don't want people wasting water. You want people only having rights to the amount of water that they actually need. So the intention was good. As Abram explained, in reality what happens is now people are afraid to do conservation. People are afraid to become more efficient because they fear their most valuable asset was going to be reduced. So it is a problem. It's a significant problem, but it's a problem that that is, it was born out of a good idea, but it just didn't work in practice very well.
So what needs to happen? All the state governors need to get together and figure out a resource allocation, or the federal government steps in, or somebody needs to do something.
Well, for starters, the federal government stepping in, I mean, those are fighting words in the West.
Everyone, sorry.
If people will agree on one thing, is that they don't want the feds to come in.
Okay.
You know, they want federal dollars to come in. Right. They don't want federal influence to come in. The thing is, water allocation is a state issue. So when we talk about it, the Western states all using this prior appropriation, first-come, first-served system, each state was free to devise their own system, and then they all came up with a pretty similar system, but still it is a state system. So if you want to start reforming some of these policies, you really have to do it on a state-by-state basis.
Hmm.
The exception to that is when you start talking about interstate rivers such as the Colorado
River. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There you might need some interstate negotiations, and the states are certainly talk to each other about these things. But there the problem is, if you get the states together, the seven states on the Colorado, and say, hey, the interstate compact isn't working very well, what should we do about it? There's great fear about even having that conversation because, you know, if you renegotiate, you know, there's only so much water. If you renegotiate and then reallocate in some way, somebody's going to end up with less. You
mm-hmm.
know, unless you can expand the pie some way, reallocation means someone deals with less. And so given that, people are pretty reluctant to talk about these issues at the interstate scale.
Well, what about just a nice big meeting to talk about who's done conservation very well?
Sure. I mean, there's been a lot of success stories in conservation in the West. Most of the big cities of the West use less water today than they did 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's impressive. In the agricultural sector, by and large, people aren't using less water than they were before, but they're getting much higher yields, so they're becoming more productive in how they use water. So these are success stories. The problem is, if you want people to go further down that road, you run into this problem of one city or one party will say, you know, if I conserve water, does that just mean that the next user downstream gets to use more water? I mean, you need some sort of
right.
coordinated system whereby one person's conservation is not offset by some other person using more. And I hear this all the time in my state of Colorado, where people say, well, if I just conserve more water, that just means people in California are going to fill up their swimming pools.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a little more complicated than that, but you can understand this idea that if people want some sort of assurance that if they do the right thing, that everyone else will also do the right thing.
Yeah. After all, as you remind us, but we may be a long way from that, aren't we all in this together?
You know, when I teach water policy to my students, I give them a list of things, a top 10 list, kind of David Letterman style, of things that they really should know about Western water. And number one on the list is we're really not all in this together.
Mm-hmm.
This water rights system that we're talking about means that some people are in a very good situation. Some people have a large water right. Some people have a very secure water right. Some people don't need to worry about these things. And other people are in a very bad situation. They either don't have a water right, or they have a very small water right, or they have a very young water right, which we call a junior water right, which means they only get water after those with an older water right take their water first. So, you know, you get some people in a very good situation who just aren't that interested in talking about changing the system, and then you get people in a very bad bad position that say, well, come on, let's talk about things. Let's be creative.
Right.
And it's a hard sell.
Yeah. Well, you just have somebody from the Midwest come in and take care of it for you.
Yeah, well, let's do that, sure.
Yeah. Let's go to phone calls. Richard in Madison is our first caller for you. Hi, Richard.
Hi. Thanks for the topic.
You're welcome.
As a Wisconsinite, I was part of the push to get the Great Lakes Water Compact agreed to
mm-hmm.
by all the states that border the Great Lakes and Quebec and Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
We did it.
We know.
Why can't people west the Colorado.
All right. It's a good question. Douglas, why?
Well, first of all, Richard, I'll tell you that I was born in Madison. And so
were.
Yeah, so I have ties to that part of the world and went to school for a while at the University of Michigan. So I know about the fear in the Midwest about people who want to build a pipeline out of the Great Lakes and take it to Los Angeles. I mean, there's people in the Columbia Basin in the Northwest are fearful of that. In recent years, the talk has been about a big pipeline out of the Mississippi River or maybe the Missouri River back toward the west. There's always going to be people with these grand engineering plans, and we can build pipelines. We know how to do that. It never makes sense financially, and it never makes sense politically. And so I was not surprised to see the Great Lakes Water Compact come into existence, which was largely motivated by trying to make it difficult to export water out of the region. And I support actions like that because I think the regions of the West need to learn to live with what Mother Nature is providing here. Trying to solve your problem by looking outside your region is usually not the way to go. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to do that in the West. We're trying to figure out how do we live with what we got. The problem is population growth is much, much more of a reality in the Southwest than it is in other places of the country. Climate change impacts are already here. This is not something we're looking 20 or 30 years down the road. It's already a major factor in water management today in the West. We just have a lot of stresses we're dealing with today.
Mm-hmm. Richard, thank you very much for the call and reminding us of the Great Lakes Water Compact. And so it might be interesting to talk about that at some point, too, how that came about. So if you have any info, send it our way. Catherine in Watertown, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Catherine.
Hi, my question is I'm not sure I'm asking the question about when did this happen. When did we have treaties with Mexico about letting the water flow into their country, I presume. I mean, you took the timeline back a little bit further than the first guest, but that doesn't seem to be in the mix at all. And now we're squabbling about the little bit that's left, and we used to actually fill the Rio Grande. Am I wrong about that?
It's interesting that you mentioned the Rio Grande. It's because the Colorado River and the Rio Grande are both shared between the United States and Mexico. Where the Colorado River originates in the U.S. and flows into Mexico, many of the biggest tributaries on the Rio Grande originate in Mexico and then flow into the United States. And so because of that arrangement, where the U.S. had some leverage, you always have leverage when you're upstream. The U.S. had some leverage on Colorado River matters. Mexico had a lot of leverage on Rio Grande issues. And so a treaty between the two states was negotiated back in 1944, and because the nations had kind of equal but offsetting leverage, the treaty was done on both of those rivers at the same time. And so that governs how much water is shared between the two countries. And it's been a fairly quiet and peaceful, and I guess that means successful, arrangement between the U.S. and Mexico. People are trying to always look for a little more creative arrangements between the two nations to try to do things more efficiently. But by and large, things between the U.S. and Mexico when it comes to water work pretty well.
Hmm. Thank you very much, Catherine, for adding that. Lori in Madison, hi.
Hi. Thank you, Kathleen, to you and your guest. I'd like to bring this back to Wisconsin once again, if I may, because we do have the regional compact, but I myself, in light of the show, I'm concerned about, for example, I think it's the city of Waukesha, isn't it, Kathleen? Maybe
yes.
You know.
Yes, yeah, it's Waukesha.
Yeah, Waukesha has petitioned to be allowed to draw water from Lake Michigan because its aquifer is depleted. And yet here there are proposed changes. A number of bills are going to be proposed in this session. That will, at least so far as I understand them, deregulate the installation or the control of high capacity, high intake wells in the state. And it doesn't seem as though this is a situation which it strikes me that the state, and we've already had public officials who have been disciplined actually for just using the words climate change. This is a situation which I think actually Wisconsin might want to take what your guest is talking about into account before, well, as we consider this legislation.
Thanks, Lori. Douglas.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say too much about what's going on there, but just a few things that might be relevant. One is, I mean, as I understand, the motivation for that compact was this very issue, this idea that that the states were going to want to start moving some water outside of the hydrologic boundary of the Great Lakes watershed. And the compact puts in rules and safeguards for not allowing that to happen. Now, I mean, I don't know the details of that, but I do know that compacts, once they're signed by the states, they get ratified by the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume this compact's been ratified. If it's been ratified, it's federal law. A state can't change it. A state can't change it on their own. That's part of the attraction of a compact, is that once it becomes ratified, it's federal law. So the only way it gets changed is if all the states agree to change it. And so that's, you know, that's a means that these agreements, once they're in place, are very hard to change, which can be viewed as a good thing or a bad thing, depending on your perspective. But no one signatory to this agreement is likely to be able to change it without the consent of the other parties.
And I stand corrected, but I believe Canada is involved in this compact as well here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which
that
makes adds another level of...
Oh, certainly.
Yeah. Lori, thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Brant in Jefferson. Hi, Brant.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Douglas.
Hi.
Hi.
This is kind of along these lines. What about desalinization on the West Coast for the drought problem in the western states?
And yeah, I mean...
my comment off the air.
Thanks, Brant.
It is certainly possible to desalinate water and... Excuse me, I'm choking here. But it's just expensive.
Are you okay?
Yeah, yeah. It requires a lot of energy, and it requires a lot of money, and that's the problem. It just doesn't make financial sense. I mean, it's not when we're feeding all this water to cattle, you know, to grow cattle crops. It just doesn't make economic sense.
Yeah, well, you get a sip of water, and we'll continue on that. Talk more about desalinization and take more phone calls too. We're talking about the Colorado River drying up, and it's affecting seven states, but affects the rest of the country too in terms of food prices, et cetera. And conversation again about the water in the Great Lakes. Can we help everybody out? No, we can't. But this is a big issue because it's going on 16 years. California drought's been bad for 4 years, doesn't show much signs of abating. So we're looking at water policy, this part of our show, and water law. Our guest is Douglas Kenny. He's director of the Western Water Policy Program, located in the University of Colorado Law School. And we're welcoming calls at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter is at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And let's go back to desalinization for just a moment, Douglas.
Sure.
You say it's expensive, but there's so many parts of the world that are deserts and dry, and with this being not just a problem here, don't you think somebody's going to figure out a way to do that and make it possible soon, inexpensive?
Well, those parts of the world you're talking about are usually parts of the world that have access to virtually unlimited cheap energy. I mean, you're talking Middle Eastern countries in many regards, and you're talking about desal just for relatively high economic valued urban uses. In those settings it can work, but when you're talking about places that use water for agriculture primarily, it's a different story.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me.
Let's go to Gail next in Fish Creek. Hi, Gail.
Thank you, my call. Great topic. I remember that Perrier tried to tap the Central Aquifer in Wisconsin, and they weren't successful. That was like maybe 15 years ago. And then about maybe a half a dozen years ago, over in Michigan, I remember hearing of a court order that had to take several times that a town went against a company that was taking water from a small lake that was fed by a spring from Lake Michigan, and they were finally so much paperwork and research had to be done to fight in court, and they finally got a cease and desist order from the judge, and I haven't heard anything else about that. But how much of this kind of thing is going on with companies taking water from pockets and small lakes and things and tapping aquifers mm-hmm. that are for business, that, of course, then you get into the lobby and the whole, you know, big game that gets played. But and how many of those companies would be foreign companies coming in, which would impact the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because then you can't say no to them because they can sue you if you don't let them do business if you bring up an issue of environmental stuff. So I'm looking at all of that. Do you have any input on that?
I guess I'd just say that rarely is that the issue, in the West at least, of large companies coming in trying to take water. It's mostly a question of those that already have water trying to keep it and fight off the growing cities. It's not companies that people worry about. It's the cities. Excuse me.
You have a cough drop?
I think it's his subject matter that's making.
Oh
me so
no!
Thirsty.
But you teach it all the time. We should have had you on talking about something else, and everything would have been fine, I guess. Gail, thank you very much for the call. Let's go next to Charlie in Monona. Hi, Charlie.
Hi. Good afternoon. I just wanted to make a comment. Doug probably knows this well, but my daughter lives in Denver. And they have a nice little garden, and I said, why don't you put a rain barrel out? And they said, can't do that. So I guess even, you know, the water rights are even to that point where you can't even gather the water that falls on your house.
That's true. Why is that? Who gets that water then, Douglas?
The thought is that if you do that, you're capturing water that otherwise would have flowed downstream that someone else has a right to.
Oh, my goodness.
So people are just afraid of tampering with water laws is what they're afraid of.
Yeah.
So, but every other state is not afraid of rain barrels. Colorado's afraid of rain barrels.
Ah. So people have been caught capturing the rain and fined?
No, I don't know of anyone that's been actually being caught. The point is, unless you make it legal, then I think stores are hesitant to sell the equipment and to create a rain barrel industry.
Yes. Yeah. Charlie, thank you very much for the call. Jeff in Wausau. Hi, Jeff.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Former resident of Santa Cruz, but when we were out there in the late 70s, early 80s, we faced the reverse. We were in the floods and the mudslides. Quite the reverse. And speaking of what causes mudslides is lack of greenery and vegetation in a lot of cases. I wanted to not be redundant, but jump back to the desalination point. Expensive, yes. However, at what cost and how many trillions or billions or millions of dollars are being lost and spent right now fighting the wildfires in the West Coast? I mean, there's got to be a point where it's not just considered for agriculture, but then again, it is considered for agriculture because you're keeping the area more drought resistant, so to speak. I mean, is there any economic sense in getting desalination plants up isn't the technology existent yet to do that?
The problem is, if you want to start with the economic argument, I would say the most economically efficient thing to do then is to, rather than desal, is you buy out low-valued agriculture. You'd buy out farms that are using flood agriculture to grow hay and alfalfa and things like that. That water is much, much cheaper than desal water. So if you want to use an economic argument, that's usually where you have to start. The problem is, you know, the problem is that no one wants to be bought out. You know, if you live in a rural community that grows alfalfa, You know, you don't want to be, you don't want to sell out, knowing that, that once you sell your water, then your area has no economic engine left to it. You know, so it becomes much, it very quickly goes from a what might make sense economically doesn't make sense socially. So you know, desal. You know, if you start looking at the economics of desal, you know, before you can, before the public's going to step up and pay for desal, they have to say, you know, why are we paying for desal when it's 10 times cheaper to buy out a farmer? It's probably 3 or 4 times cheaper just to invest in conservation within our cities and use that water freed up for other things. But desal's always going to have this economic liability to it. And there's other liabilities as well. But the economic liability, I just don't see going away for desal, except in some very limited circumstances. And those circumstances are providing water to a big city during a drought emergency. Mm-hmm. That's about the only time it's going to probably make sense, in this century at least, mm-hmm. to do desal on a large scale.
Douglas, where are we in terms of how severe these issues are, in terms of how they're affecting farmers and droughts and availability of water and fighting fires and all of that? Is this are we at a real bad stage right now, and action simply has to be taken on a variety of fronts, or is that yet to be?
You know, it's a really bad stage for some users, and it's really not a problem for others. And that's the
problem.
That's kind of the political problem.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's, but all the trends are pointed in the wrong direction. All the trends are for more growth, more demands for water, but yet all the trends are for less precipitation or less stream flows, at least. Maybe not less precipitation, but just less stream flows. You know, it's to the extent that places are tight on water supplies today, they figure to be even tighter 10 or 20 years from now. So, you know, at some point, you know, with every passing year, let me put it this way, with every passing year, this becomes more and more of a problem for more and more people, you know, and at some point you hit some magic threshold where there's enough people that say, you know, we really need to rethink what we're doing and do things differently.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting awfully close to that point in some places of the West. I don't think we're getting to that point in most other places of the country.
Yeah. Mike in Madison, hi.
Hi. I guess your guest sort of alluded to what I wanted to comment on, but you know, with the population growth continuing out west, these conservation measures are basically offset by that population growth. And it does. I haven't heard an answer yet or any solution to reducing the number of cattle in these states to building any nuclear power plants. It sounds like you just, you know, everybody's waiting for the final shoe to drop in 3 years or 5 years from now, and to the point where rationing becomes a reality and you get so much water per person and that's it.
Well, I mean, at the heart of your question is this idea that that population growth is driving a lot of these problems, and that's true, and we don't know how to manage population growth. I mean, who does? I mean, the only country I know that's tried to manage population growth, China, has over 1 billion people. You know, it's just hard to deal with this driver of population growth when it's not something anyone thinks they can manage. So you get a lot of stopgap measures. You know, each community has their own water system, and they say, hey, if we do such and such, then we can get by for the next 20 or 30 years, and then it's the next generation's problem, you know. And so there's a lot of that. A lot of these decisions are made, you know, there's no Western water czar, you know. There's a lot of little communities and a lot of different decision makers, and they all make decisions that say, hey, how can we kick this issue down the road another 20 or 30 years and let the next generation deal with it?
Yes.
And that's part of the problem is, you know, any sort of solution that rings of a centralized planning or a larger federal scheme makes people really nervous.
Mm-hmm. Well, Douglas, you've been most informative. Thank you very much for being with us for a discussion and get a cough drop and some water. Okay, thank you. Thanks. Douglas Kenny, director of the Western Water Policy Program. It's located at the University of Colorado Law School. He does research on all kinds of water-related issues. And we thank him for being with us. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour. And thanks to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Tomorrow, during this hour, tomorrow we'll be talking about the Moth Radio Hour. They're having a big show in Milwaukee this week. And it's really caught on, this idea of storytelling, why we still find it incredibly compelling. And we'll be talking about that. First hour, President Barack Obama's foreign policy success or failure. John Munson will be filling in for me tomorrow. I know I've been gone a little bit the last couple of weeks. I've had some health things to take care of, but don't worry, I'm here. I'll be all right.